Donald Ritchie grew up in Northwest Ohio in the 1930s. He spent a lot of time going to the movies. Eventually, the cinema became his preferred reality. Ritchie learned to understand America through its movies. And so when he moved to Japan, it was no surprise that he spent a lot of time watching Japanese films. So much time, in fact, that Donald Ritchie is now the foremost Western authority on Japanese film. Ritchie is the author of 100 years of Japanese film. From the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City, he told Steve Paulson about the first really memorable Japanese film that he saw.
The first picture that I saw that really made an impression was the first Ozu film that I saw, and I had no idea who Ozu was, and I didn't know I was seeing one of his films. I saw Record of a Tenement Gentleman, which is his first post-war film, and I was very impressed by that. Not that I understood it, since naturally these films did not have titles, and I was seeing them with a Japanese audience, and I had no idea what the dialogue or even what the story was. But when this occurs, when you are not blinded by story and you're distracted by dialogue, then you begin to notice how the director carves up his space or how he separates his time, how he treats these spatial temporal elements. And of course, you're then in a position to understand assumptions that a culture makes about itself. And so you can really learn about the country whose films you're seeing.
Let's go back to the beginning of Japanese cinema, the silent era. What were Japanese films like in those days?
Well, they were, and they remain to an extent, rather radically different, and I think the difference is historical. When cinema first came to the West, it was perceived as a child of photography. I mean, the father is still photographed, and then along comes the toddler, which moves. This was how it was apprehended in the West. In the East, however, particularly in Japan, which had movies before anybody else, and about 1898, when the first imported films came in, it was perceived not as a child of photography, because there's no strong photographic tradition in Japan. It was seen as a child of the drama. And so this was a new form of drama. So hence, all of the assumptions about drama were carried over into the new films. That is, you had representation didn't mean anything. It doesn't in photography.
So in other words, it wasn't so important to be realistic.
It is even now a quality which is nowhere commensurate in importance with what it is in the West. And so with the Western films becoming more and more representational, the Japanese films went right on being presentational. It always assumes that somebody's doing the presenting, that somebody's standing in between you and the reality that you are observing. And in the no drama, it's the chorus. And in the kabuki, it is the gidayu player and singer. And in the movies, it became the benchi, this man who stood beside the screen and told you what you were seeing while you were seeing it and suggesting how you feel about it. This condition, it still continues. So it does make Japanese films different in a very subtle kind of way, even now.
You're saying there are still these benchis who stand
up? No, there's no benchi anymore, except a sort of a scholarly reconstruction that's carted out from time to time. But the assumptions that created the benchi are still the assumptions which, in a way, control an audience.
Now, what's curious about this tradition of the benchi, these live narrators who would get up during the films, is this tradition continued well into the era of the talkies. It didn't just end when people started talking on screen.
That's true. It continued on because people had the benchi had a vested interest in themselves. They fought back, but eventually they were killed by Gary Cooper, because Gary Cooper came in and made a tremendous hit in 1931 with the film Morocco, and they couldn't fight Gary Cooper, and so they succumbed.
What were those early Japanese films about?
They were usually about something from the stage, little stories from the kabuki or from the shimpa theater or from the Shingokugeki sword fight pictures. They were dramatic in narrative. They were what we'd call anecdotes rather than plot. And, of course, naturally, in that period, all the films were short. But they didn't have, you know, newsreels. They didn't have, you know, the waves rolling up in Deauville, or they didn't have, you know, things which are not connected with the stage until much, much later.
I was very surprised to read in your book that Japan, for a number of years up until the Second World War, actually made more movies than any other country in the world.
And so it did. It had a populace that didn't have really any other form of entertainment, and it did. It in India had hundreds of films a year. This is no longer true, certainly. I mean, in many countries, films numbers have been reduced, even in India. So in Japan, we have this radical reduction of, you know, what's available. People now watch television. And also the demographics of film going have changed. It used to be that the Japanese, certainly directly after World War II, only had the Japanese films to look at. And then little by little, the ratio changed. I suppose out of 100 Japanese, maybe one or two goes and sees Japanese pictures now. The other 98 or 99 go to see the foreign films.
Now, one thing that's striking, especially when you look back at some of the early Japanese films, is there's really a very distinct aesthetic. A lot of those great filmmakers from the early years, Mizoguchi and Ozu, really had a different aesthetic than what you would see in Hollywood. What was going on there?
Well, given the history, of course, it'd be strange if they didn't carry over the aesthetic of Japanese theatricality. This informs the films of Mizoguchi, the idea that you are a spectator and that you sit in the front row and that you watch, as you would on the stage, for a very long scene. Even though the camera may pan or dolly or something, nonetheless, the scene itself is long. This is an assumption of continuity, which is shared with the stage.
I remember the first time I saw a Mizoguchi film, I was so struck by how different it was from the typical American film, because I don't remember what it was, but it was some kind of domestic drama, and it was getting very intense, but the camera was kept way back. I mean, those people you were watching on the screen were at a distance, and he seemed to scorn the use of close-ups. I mean, in a Hollywood movie, you'd zoom in at the moment of great impact, but he wouldn't do that.
No, that's precisely so. He did not do that. He did it for a reason. He once said that his recipe for perfection in film was to have the camera as far away as possible, running for as long as possible. What he wanted to do was to have the atmosphere of the scene comment upon the characters, showing how it forms them, which is a good Japanese ethos. And at the same time, he did not want to interrupt performance, and this he gets from the performing side of the tradition that formed him. And he was also able to control and make compositions. Compositions can speak. I mean, if you see Rashomon, for example, which is by Kurosawa, not by Mizoguchi, nonetheless, those triangular compositions illuminate the triangle of the story that you're following. In the same way, in the case of Mizoguchi, the loneliness of his women characters and the awful things that happen to them are presaged by the fact that they're very much alone in a scene, or in a scene where the composition itself will comment upon them.
You mentioned Rashomon by Kurosawa, which came out in 1950. Why is this such an important film?
It wasn't really considered such an important film in Japan, although people went to it, until it started winning prizes abroad. It was the first Japanese film to win a major prize. And when it came back, you know, garlanded with all sorts of foreign prizes and reviews and things like this, then the Japanese took a second look at it. What it is, of course, is we go through the same story 4, 5, 6 times, and each time it is the same, and each time it is different because we see it from a different person's point of view. This is a technique which, of course, we know in the West from people like Pirandello and so forth, but this is also a Japanese technique. These stories are based upon a very well-known series of stories by Akutagawa Ryunosuke. And so, again, it's this combination of things. In the West, they called it a puzzle picture. They couldn't figure it out because our idea of reality is that it's only one. Mm-hmm. In Japan, the people who made it, the people who saw it, could accept it right away because everybody knows that there's as many realities as there are observers.
And, of course, there's an underlying philosophy to this, that there is no single truth. It all depends on where you come from.
That's true. And in the West, this was called a nihilistic film. This was called, you know, this one denied reason, and the great Rashomon murder mystery idea was buffeted about by the critics. In Japan, nobody ever called it a murder mystery. It's quite a part of the Japanese tradition that there is no settled truth, that you judge everything case by case, as it were. And that's what these people were doing with this rape and this murder. They were looking at it case by case. And if you really work at it, as I did in my book on Kurosawa, there's actually a way to reconcile almost, if you lie a little, to reconcile all of these stories.
Donald Ritchie is the author of 100 Years of Japanese Film. He spoke with Steve Paulson from the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City.